Welcome to Digging the Dharma, where we dig into the Buddhist Dharma and explore ways to bring these 2,500-year-old teachings into our lives. I'm Doug Smith of Doug's Dharma on YouTube and the online Dharma Institute.
And I'm John Aaron, teacher at New York Insight Meditation Center and mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher and teacher trainer and founder of Space to Meditate. Greetings, Doug. Good to see you.
Great to see you as well, John. How are you? How have you been doing?
I've been doing all right. Although I have to say right now, you look a little pixelated in my camera, but I assume you don't feel pixelated.
So I'm feeling all right. Yeah, a little tired, a little sleepy, but that's all right. Pixelated may be the result.
I mean, it's kind of interesting when you think about, you know, the idea of non-self and video and, you know, when we start to pixelate and fuzziness, you know. Well, where is it ending and where is it beginning?
But, yeah, the difficulties of having to use a screen in between us rather than being in the
right.
Same.
Although it was nice to see you in prison the other day, because I realized we hadn't seen each other for like 4 years.
It's been a while.
I don't think I've seen you since COVID.
Yeah.
In three dimensions.
It doesn't seem so long, but on the other hand, yeah, it must have been because COVID intervened and it just...
It was all timeless after, you know, once COVID started.
Time,
it really took a weird turn, I think.
Yeah.
And as we know, time is only a fabrication. So, so here we are.
Here we are.
That's actually kind of interesting. Think about it as if, you know, when we talk about fabrications, because we wanted to talk today about truthfulness.
Yeah.
Partly in the context of the paramis, which the teaching collaborative at New York Insight has been surveying the paramis for the last 7 months. And last night I was giving a talk on the parami of truthfulness, which can be seen and kind of played with in many different ways. And the obvious, most obvious ways, excuse me, is in our speech.
Mm.
I was kind of... And I spoke about that, but I was also sort of seeing it in, to some degree, in terms of the idea of the two truths, but, you know, in sort of relative and absolute, but also in the idea that, you know, we have our kind of day-to-day thinking mind, thinking in language and words and communicating in the ways it needs to. But then beneath that, there's something else. And so I was kind of playing with the notion that if we're really speaking from a place of truthfulness, we're speaking from the heart versus from the thinking mind, which isn't to say the thinking mind isn't like coming out with true facts. That certainly can be the case and hopefully most often is. But I'm sort of personally, at least, considering truthfulness to be something that is authentic in the sense that it's felt in a particular way and it's experienced not through language, but through something else.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about sort of authenticity, I was going to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Being authentic.
It is authenticity.
Because, I mean, there's different kinds. I mean, truth, you know, speaking sort of as putting my philosopher's hat on, truth is usually understood to be a property of sentences or propositions.
Right.
So, you know, sentences can be true or false. Propositions can be true or false. So truth is sort of a property of conceptual things, you know. If you're talking about authenticity, then what we're really after is, you know, being able to be truthful about something that sort of is deep within us, you know, and being able to express that in a way that is accurate, that we're not trying to cover things up, we're not trying to be in, or we're not ending up being inauthentic about our true feelings in a particular case.
Right.
And then we have to have that kind of insight into our own, you know, sort of inner workings, which isn't always easy.
Well, exactly. And that's, you know, I think where... So if we put it in the context of, say, right view, right, which, you know, right view having to do with seeing clearly the nature of existence, basically the nature, the impermanent nature and the non-self nature and the nature of dukkha, And if we truly see that and have experienced it, obviously not for most of us, not all the time, but I mean, it's there and there's a knowing of that, then the words that we speak, or even not even the words that we speak, but, and this is where it gets interesting, is that like the thoughts that arise, you know, are filtered through that lens, through that view.
Mm.
And, you know, that is, I would say, is real truthfulness. So, you know, we have this level of thinking in words, and obviously from a right or factually right or proposition being right or proposition being wrong, or however we want to language that, beneath the words, there's something else.
Mm.
And I know in the Sufi context, there are these three gates, which I know you've heard me talk about, right? Which is, you know, the gate of, is it factually true? So that's the first gate. And then, is it necessary? Is it appropriate? And then is it from the heart, basically? Mm. Is it authentic?
Right. Well, the Buddha talks also about the same kind of thing, that, you know, that you should speak certain truths at the right time in the right place.
Right.
If they're not easy to hear, you know, that you should be careful. You know, people say, yeah, I mean, there's this kind of idea that you should always be truthful with people. And so therefore, you know, you have people who are sort of big mouths who sort of, you know, tell people what they think and all the time. And that's not necessarily a good idea either. In fact, it's not a good idea. you know, you have to pick your time and place. And I would certainly argue that there are certain truths that it's probably better not even to say ever. Because they just don't, they're not helpful. They're not useful. They're not beneficial. They would only hurt somebody's feelings. Now, I mean, in the perfect world, you know, where we're all enlightened, then no truth should be able to hurt anybody's feelings. But we're not there, and we have to understand that. I mean, I was going to say the other fact here is that when we're looking, we're talking about, let's say, the Four Noble Truths, there is certainly a propositional understanding of them where we say, you know, we express the Four Noble Truths, we perhaps believe the Four Noble Truths. But I think, you know, when we're talking about authenticity, you know, we have to get beneath the words. And theoretically, there's some level of authenticity in which we understand them, perhaps. But I think for most of us, and I'll speak for myself only, you know, when you get below the level of sort of propositional belief and understanding, there's a sense in which we don't really, or at least I don't feel like I have a complete grasp on them if I'm being completely authentic.
Sure.
Because I don't act absolutely from them all the time, you know?
Right, right. And that was actually something that came up for me last night when I was giving this talk, because I was talking about, you know, I generally have a sense, particularly when I'm teaching, when I'm speaking from my heart versus when I'm speaking from my head. And usually when I'm speaking from my head, I realize I don't know what I'm talking about, in a sense, you know, or that something is not right in the response. So somebody asks, well, how do I know? How do I know whether it's from the head or the heart? And wouldn't somebody who's, you know, who's a teacher naturally only speak from the heart? And I said, well, I know this teacher doesn't always do that. And I've been in, you know, with other teachers who I know don't, you know, fall into, you know, we fall into to those places because we're so used to it. We're so used to thinking in a certain way and processing thought in a particular way that we don't always stop and actually check in. And this idea of checking in as to whether it is, you know, where the words are coming from, where the ideas are coming from, how am I responding to another?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it from my head or from my heart? And of course, what I realized after speaking later with somebody in the class last night was, you know, as usual, when it comes to speech, the people you're closest to are the people where you find yourself, at least me, I find myself falling into old habits and not necessarily speaking from my heart, not waiting for the appropriate response, often because it's just about day-to-day stuff, right? And so when it's when we have the ability to respond so quickly to things, we don't necessarily check on truthfulness, right? And certainly we don't check to see, well, is this coming from, you know, where is this coming from? You know, because we have this very quick ability to just use words in a kind of almost an automatic way. And we get into danger. And certainly we see it. Certainly we see that in the political world and in other arenas where nobody listens to anybody. And very few people actually listen to their heart in terms of, well, what's really true here.
It depends on what's being discussed, I guess. I mean, you say in daily life, we speak automatically, and I think that's true. We absolutely speak automatically in daily life to people that aren't close to us.
Yeah.
But, I mean, most of the time we're talking about relatively benign or...
Of course. I mean,
in the broad sense of things, unimportant, you know, we're talking about what we're going to have for dinner or, you know, whatever, you know, chatting about whatever it happens to be. The time that I think you're talking about where we're trying to get deep and touch the bottom of the ocean, as it were.
Right.
Those are relatively rare, at least in ordinary life, I think, unless we're, you know, in a really, really deep group of people.
I think certainly in a teaching mode, one is in that, or teaching meditation anyway, and teaching mindfulness. I mean, it's because ideally we talk about being embodied in the practice. And if one is embodied in the practice, then hopefully the space is present for one to check in before one opens one's mouth.
Yeah. On the other hand, you also do want, I mean, at least from my, I mean, of course, my teaching style is different from yours in the sense that mine is more sort of scholarship based rather than, you know, yours as being sort of more grounded. You know, I mean, you're more interested in that kind of real authenticity, which is the great way to teach meditation. If you're teaching scholarship, a lot of it is true. It's up in the mind. The reason it is, at least for me, I mean, I can say for my own sake again, is that a lot of what I'm discussing, let's say in videos about scholarship, about, you know, what is, you know, enlightenment, what is nirvana, and you look at the early texts and you see what the Buddha talked about, is because I'm not there. I mean, I'm not, you know, and I don't feel that I have any ability to sort of touch in and say, okay, this is nirvana. This is what, you know, because I've seen it myself. I may have seen glimpses of something, but I wouldn't call it that, you know.
Right,
I mean,
right. Sure. Likewise.
Yeah. And so when I'm looking for an answer to that question that can be helpful to people, the only way that I can do it is through the scholarship and saying, okay, well, I can't tell you myself, but I can say, here's what the texts say. Here's what it seems that, you know, if you look at this sutta, the Buddha talks about it here, and that sutta, he talks about it there in this way. And so we can sort of triangulate on it, you know, by getting it from a bunch of different directions. And a lot of that material is how I sort of tend to, I think I have a certain skill set, which is very good at sort of doing that.
Yeah.
Which is not the same as the skill set of other people. And so that's sort of the way I approach it, which is, it's true, it's not really a way of getting, you know, sort of authentically at my own experience, because my own experience, it's just not there yet, you know, and so I could just, you know,
and
just avoid
also,
the question, I guess.
Yeah. But. Well, also, I think, you know, there's a difference between, you know, when you're recording yourself and basically speaking to a camera, not to say that you can't, that there aren't people who, when they are speaking to a camera and talking about Dharma, and there's nobody in front of them, not to say that there isn't a deep embodied presence, because, you know, that certainly is possible. And there's not something, it's not like you think, oh, am I embodied? Right. Or how do I be embodied? Right. It's like, okay, what's here now and what's true now? And my cognitive knowledge, you know, of the Dharma, how is it going to come out in this moment, you know, as I speak about it? And so, you know, I think that it's not either or, it's both and, right? And that's why those three gates are important, right? I mean, is it factually accurate? And is it the time to say it? And then where is it coming from, right? Is it coming from the head or is it coming from the heart? And if it's coming from the head, that doesn't mean there's not truthfulness there. It's just a different kind of truthfulness, I would say. It's a factual right. truthfulness and,
right.
and an appropriateness. And there can be more as well.
Yeah, I mean, the one other aspect of that is that when you're doing scholarship, there is a sense, a slightly different sense of authenticity, which is that you're trying to be as authentic as you can to the material in front of you.
Right.
Trying, as much as you can, not to bring your own baggage to the material, which is always impossible. I mean, you're always bringing your own baggage, but you're trying to do your best, as the best you can,
yeah.
to see the material from its own side, as it were, you know, to try to see the material and try to be as authentic to the material as you can be. And that's what doing good scholarship is. For example, sometimes I will read a book, and I had this experience several years ago with a friend of mine, read a book in the Dharma where the person makes a bunch of claims about the Dharma and avoids all the counterexamples. So they say, oh, this is what the early Dharma was talking about, making a bunch of claims. And I came to that and I said, well, but there are all these suttas that contradict that, those claims. And this person never mentions those suttas in this entire book. So that, to me, is not being authentic to the actual material. It's fine if you have your opinion, and you know, but if you're going to come at it as I'm trying to do scholarship here,
right?
And you simply don't mention parts of the early suttas that contradict what you're saying. That to me is not good scholarship. That to me is just kind of propaganda, if you like.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, and it's fine if you say, okay, I have these, there are these other suttas that say this that don't agree with me, but this is the reasons why I don't think that we should believe them. Fine. Okay, so make your case, but don't just avoid them, you know, which is the problem you see in some what I consider bad scholarship. So
right. That's
the kind of thing I'm talking about, of trying to take all of the suttas, you know, as much as we can into account, you know, try to be as authentic as we can to the material.
And I think, you know, in terms of the Dharma, in terms of suttas, you know, it's one thing to read it.
Mm.
It's another thing to take it into your own practice and then live it.
Yep, for sure.
Right. And so if you're teaching from that place, having taken it in, investigated, lived it, then you're really speaking from a place of authenticity and hopefully factually, you know, accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And so even, I mean, and we know, of course, that in the teachings, there are so many teachings that the Buddha was always teaching to a specific group, right? And so, you know, he might say one thing to one group and another thing to another group, which gets one to the same place, but seems contradictory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. On the surface, it seems contradictory.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what you're referring to when, you know, so, and yet, you know, we certainly know, you know, people like Bhikkhu Anālayo, who I think before he writes anything, I believe anyway, that he's seriously practiced with it for a long time before he puts it in writing. And so it's like, oh, okay, this is really coming from an experience. And I find myself often, and this is not helpful, And you know, it's a kind of real communication guideline, is that we speak from our own experience. And I'll often go, you know, sort of fall into the royal we, which is just not helpful, or can be helpful, you know, but I have to like often correct myself, you know, and say, well, actually, you know, in my experience, how it's evolved, or, you know, where I've noticed when I'm not speaking from a really true place, something doesn't feel right. It's almost a gut feeling, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that in Gregory Kramer's insight dialogue tradition, you know, he has several instructions, one of which is to listen deeply, and the other of which is to speak the truth. And in this idea of listening deeply, we are dropping below that traditional flow of words into something else. And so it's like, okay, so I'm hearing a teaching. What's arising in this experience, in this moment, around that teaching, or whether it's impermanence or non-self, you know, where is the self getting in the way of the truth? Mm-hmm. Maybe that's another way of putting it. That's the investigation. Where is the construction of this self getting in the way of what's really true?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very rich practice.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you bring it, you know, into kind of normal relational, not insight relational practice, but just normal relational practice, you know, is it even possible? And it's funny, there was somebody last night who said, well, this is somebody who had just come off retreat and was really still kind of resonating with the retreat, which was quite an experience for this person. And, you know, I was like, well, like, if I have to go into a board meeting, you know, do I need to stop and like take a moment to sink in and I'll be right with you, you know, while I'm kind of, I think I said, you know, you just have to like pause and see what's really there and you'd be surprised at how powerful silence can be in those moments. You know, it doesn't have to be for 5 minutes. It can be for 30 seconds, but there's something really powerful in that silence.
Mm.
I think I started actually last night with a quote from Thomas Keating, the Jesuit priest, I think, who said, "Silence is the language of God. Everything else is a bad interpretation." you know, which is just pointing
very
to the
zen.
Fact. What? Yeah, isn't it? Exactly. And well, I mean, if we look at the Heart Sutra, right? It's like all these words that we use are just words. You know, and we have to see through that. You know, so this is where the absolute and the relative come into play. It's like, you know, we need the relative truth to get through the day and to deal with the normal, you know, as Rumi would say, the plumbing learning, the kind of facts that we gain throughout our life. And, you know, how do we work with that? And then there's something deeper than that.
Yeah, and then the relative things point at the, you know, the relative truth is the finger pointing. So it helps us to find that.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's useful.
You just have to remember.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a very interesting, you know, it's a really interesting place of practice to like check in before you open your mouth. I mean, especially, I'm not talking about like in a day-to-day situation, but just, you know, if you're having a, well, even without speaking, I mean, just in terms of the way we listen to our thoughts, you know, do we really attend to all these thoughts? Do we really believe all these thoughts? If we kind of look beneath that as we are in meditation, you know, just say, okay, and there's something else here.
Mm.
There's this poem by Annie Leichhardt that I read called The Other Music, which is just talking about like there's the music that we hear all the time. And then there's something just below that music, which is the other music that, you know, that's there all along, but with it's quieter and we don't necessarily pay attention to it. And it's that, you know, it's like remembering to check that out.
Mm.
It can be really an interesting way to sort of, I suppose, get to a different kind of truthfulness. Heartfulness, or however we want to see it.
And I think, I mean, one of the things about authenticity, which you're getting back to that again, is just, well, you were talking about using the royal we or whatever it is. I mean, speaking in terms of the we, is sort of being able to distinguish or trying to distinguish between those things that we express because we know them ourselves or feel them ourselves versus those things that we express because we've read them somewhere or
right.
You know, and that certainly is one way to be authentic. And one way that I try to be authentic is to say, okay, this is, you know, this is from this and this is what I, you know, this is my experience, but this is, you know, this is what I've read here, but this is my experience. So that to keep those two separate is, you know, and to understand that there is a difference.
Right, to recognize them as separate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's a big area of practice. Always.
Yeah. And kindness, I think, is part should be in the background here. All of the idea of, in a certain sense, that's the ground floor of the Buddha's ethics. And truthfulness is good because it's kind. It's kind to ourselves and kind to others. And so, you know, we shouldn't use it as a cudgel. So I think some people will use truthfulness, as I've said before, as this kind of a, you know, we have to speak the truth. And some of that is useful, but at the right time and place.
Oh, yeah. Right speech.
Yeah.
And truthfulness go hand in hand. So, friends, I think we can say that one bit of truth for us is that we enjoy our coffee.
Yes.
True coffee.
As opposed to the fake stuff.
Yeah.
The inauthentic coffee.
Yeah, authentic coffee. And if you are enjoying this podcast, and many of you express that, we appreciate your support, which you can do at diginthedharma.com by buying us coffee.
Yeah, or subscribing, even.
Yeah.
It helps defray the costs.
It defrays the cost of this technology that we use.
Crazy technology.
Yeah. So we hope this has been helpful and look forward to seeing you next time. And in the meantime, keep digging the Dharma.
See you later, John.
All right. Take care. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on your podcast directory. And please check us out at diginthedharma.com, where you can leave a comment, buy us a coffee, and even become a member. You can find out more about me, John Aaron, at johnaaron.net, and Doug at dougsdharma.com.